is it that hotel Wi-Fi is so expensive and sometimes so spotty? Who won't you see at the Black Hat and DEF CON conferences this year? When is broadband hard to deploy and why? And Amazon digs deep in announcing new investment into India. That's not all, but it's a start. Welcome back to 40 AM and 5, the weekly download of 40 AM LLC. It's Monday, August 4th, and I'm Chris Bohm. First up, on August 5th of last year, we reported on a speech by General Keith Alexander, then director of the National Security Agency, who faced a standing-room-only crowd at the Black Hat Annual Hacker Conference. General Alexander's appearance at the time seemed a part of a public relations campaign, his having given a similar speech earlier in July at a national security conference in Aspen, Colorado. His message to the Black Hat mixed technical details with broad-based strategic justifications, part of a shift inside the Pentagon and the intelligence community at the time toward a more open stance about cybersecurity and national security. According to the Washington Post at the time, some Black Hat attendees were very receptive to Alexander's message, but yet some remained skeptical. It was a very solid presentation, said one security engineer. However, the Snowden disclosures had made the relationship between the NSA and hackers more complicated. Talented hackers who might have considered working with the government will think twice now, according to interviews conducted at the event by the Post. As reported by The Guardian this past week, Admiral Mike Rogers and Rick Leggett, the new director and deputy director of the NSA, won't be at Black Hat or DEF CON this year. U.S. intelligence will still have some representation, according to The Guardian, with Dan Greer, a highly respected information security expert, who presently serves as security chief of InQtel, the technology investment arm of the CIA and broader intelligence community, to have given a keynote at Black Hat this past Saturday. In the wake of the revelations by Edward Snowden, coming on the heels of a 2012 keynote given by General Keith Alexander, at which he denied that the NSA was collecting dossiers on millions of people, DEF CON founder Jeff Moss publicly urged employees of the federal government at the time to take a time out from the convention. That time out is seemingly no longer in force, with organizers encouraging researchers from both the private and public sectors to apply for a speaking slot at any of our annual shows, as reported by The Guardian. However, convincing people with advanced technical skills to work for the NSA rather than a private firm has apparently long been a difficult sell for the agency, according to The Guardian's Ackerman. But the lack of trust brought on by the Snowden disclosures has, unfortunately, not made the pitch any easier. The Amazon is about as far from the Ganges River as you can get on the map. Not so in cyberspace, it turns out. As this past week, Amazon announced that it will invest an additional $2 billion in India to boost its operations there. We see huge potential in the Indian economy and for the growth of e-commerce in India, Chief Executive Jeff Bezos said in a statement. And India is on track to become our fastest growing company ever to reach $1 billion in gross sales. According to the BBC, Amazon's decision comes just a day after India's largest domestic e-commerce firm, Flipkart, raised the equivalent of $1 billion in additional funding, the largest ever for an internet firm in India. India's total e-commerce market equaled roughly $13 billion in 2013, with online travel accounting for more than 70% of its transactions, according to the BBC. And according to Forrester Research, online sales of retail goods in India reached roughly $1.6 billion, with expectations that the level could be as high as $76 billion by 2021. Have you ever wondered why it is that you can go on vacation with your family, stay at a good tourist hotel, and get free, great Wi-Fi while you're there? Then the next week, you're in, say, Brazil for business, and a day's worth of Wi-Fi costs you roughly what you would also pay for dinner in the hotel's restaurant. Why is that great hotel that you stay at for work, and admittedly, get a great deal of work done, charging you so much more for the technology basics? According to Tony Rapetti, a hotel management professor at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, who spoke to NPR's Marketplace in April of this year, it's simple. The easy answer to that is because they can. Luxury hotels, or hotels that most often cater to business clients, can charge more because they know that their customers will most often pay more. It's what economists call price sensitivity, as Jeff Beck, a former Marriott executive who teaches at Michigan State's business school, pointed out to Marketplace. A $20 a day fee on a $400 a day room is probably not a big deal when the company is paying $400 for you to do work there. Or for that matter, if you can afford to make that hotel your tourist destination, the $20 isn't likely to bother you either. According to Marketplace, things are changing, even if slowly. The website Hotel Chatter conducts a long-running survey of hotel Wi-Fi. And as managing editor, Juliana Shellcross, told Marketplace, nearly two-thirds of hotels offer it free, and it's a number that's growing. The change is happening in part because we live in the age of online reviews and social media, and companies that give hotels a lot of business are complaining too. Nobody wants unhappy customers. But as Tony Rapetti pointed out to Marketplace, be careful what you wish for, as many hotels are also increasing their room rates to make up for the lost charges. You may not see it, but they are increasing, even if just by a little bit. This past week, NPR's All Things Considered, Elise Hugh brought up a different problem. What if, as a business traveler, you're in a great location and your hotel Wi-Fi has the download speeds of an early 1990s dial-up connection? It happens to all of us. About 6 years ago, I was staying at an upper mid-priced business chain hotel in central London, and the Wi-Fi connection was so intermittent that, at least that evening, some of the hotel's staff were offering to comp your fee-based Wi-Fi charges at the nearby Starbucks if you wanted to go there. At least in this instance, the hotel, or at least some of the staff, was giving regular guests a solution. As Elise Hugh pointed out this past week, there are now a couple of websites and apps that are attempting to solve this problem, not by making your hotel Wi-Fi any better, mind you, but at least by giving you the location's up and download speeds before you book. Hotel Wi-Fi Test, for instance, is crowdsourcing its speed data by having customers run tests when they visit a hotel. The cities currently on the site are among the biggest: New York, San Francisco, Amsterdam. SpeedSpot also compiles its data through crowdsourcing, according to NPR, and has a bigger database. But unlike some others, as NPR noted, it doesn't also tell you whether the hotel slaps on the daily Wi-Fi charge. A little bit ago, I read Peter Schweier and Annie Anton's article, "Engineers and Lawyers in Privacy Protection. Can't we just all get along?" The article was part of the larger Privacy Engineers Manifesto, which I haven't read, but the article itself was terrific. For any of us who, as practitioners, have taken great pains to extrapolate dense legal and regulatory privacy-related obligations into everyday parlance, and failed, or at least not lived up to our own mentors' expectations, we know that the relationship between lawyers and technologists and how we do or don't understand each other's objectives, everyday problems, or sometimes even language, is the holy grail in terms of tech industry compliance. We know that we can design training documents, modules, and practice and procedure lists for system users and administrative personnel. But few are the practitioners who can, before the training is even rolled out, have the rules before them and an understanding of the policy-based intent. And if the opportunity is there to have these conversations, assist an engineer in designing systems, apps, or data exchanges in a way that is compliant, but doesn't also break a system, a business plan, an innovation pathway, or worse, a supervisor's will or budget. Ian Oliver puts this conundrum in perspective this past week in the International Association of Privacy Professionals' Privacy Perspectives column. As he explains, often a privacy issue is solved, quote-unquote, by hashing an identifier, encrypting a communications link, or anonymizing a data set. But in the end, these, of course, are band-aid solutions. What is reasonable under the law means nothing to the engineer, and the mere act of encrypting a link hides, as Ian Oliver puts it, an enormous complexity of network protocols, key management, performance, encryption libraries, and so on. Ian Oliver's article, Bridging the Gap Between Privacy Engineers and Lawyers, as well as the piece by Peter Schweier and Annie Anton, Engineers and Lawyers in Privacy Protection, are both well worth the read. A team of researchers from the University of California at Berkeley, along with colleagues at MIT, have developed an algorithm that adjusts the intensity of each direction of light that emanates from a single pixel in an image viewed on a computer tablet screen. In short, they've developed a prototype tablet display that can compensate for the individual user's vision problems. According to the BBC, the system uses software to alter the light from each individual pixel based upon the person's glasses prescription. And as the BBC points out, about 40% of the people in the U.S. suffer from myopia or nearsightedness, whereas it's 1 in 3 in the U.K., and more than half the population in Asia. The prototype used an iPod with a printed pinhole mask attached to the screen. A standard camera had been adjusted to mimic a prescribed vision deficit, and the images appearing on the camera were in fact adjusted. One of the key issues to making this prototype broadly accessible may be battery drain, as it's unknown at this stage to the researchers how such correction software and add-ons may impact a standard mobile tablet. According to the BBC, their research is to be presented at a conference in Vancouver later this month. An article by The Guardian, Samuel Gibbs, this past week highlighted a not often discussed conundrum in broadband service provision. What are some of the impediments that can often impede getting the line and eventually the service to your door? Gibbs' article spotlighted the difficulties that London's Old Street technology startups seem to be having getting broadband installed up and running. The Hackney South and Shoreditch areas of London are part of an area dubbed Tech City, but as The Guardian piece reports, lengthy installation delays and high fees have caused some of the companies to apparently leave the area, while others complained of months of costly cumbersome holdups upon moving to new offices in the zone. One newly moved company reported that mix-ups with addresses, wiring, and hardware deliveries eventually translated to slow SDSL backup lines being active a week after their move. But a fiber line wasn't finally made active until just under 4 months after they'd been in the suite. Until that time, most of the firm worked from home or relied on bonded 4G wireless dongles for broadband. While it may be easy to blame internet service providers in the zone, including BT, Virgin Media, and TalkTalk, and some have, the difficulty highlights some of the many costs, logistical challenges, of installing broadband in an already heavily developed area. As The Guardian points out, a simple broadband order sets in motion a multi-stage process, at present involving bartering deals, on-site visits, permits, digging up roads, and eventually an installation. Virgin Media's head of public affairs, Dan Butler, told The Guardian that roughly 85% of their installation costs are sunk into planning regulation, narrow trenching, and sometimes limitations on roadworks. Some of Tech City's routes contain some of London's busiest and most strictly controlled roads. The government has come forward with a broadband connection voucher scheme, which apparently does allay some of the costs, but not the time it takes to install. Some critics suggested in The Guardian piece that the problem will likely remain until internet connections are treated like water or electricity, in that the builder or landlord of a property is required to make connections as part of doing business. In many upscale communities, developments are engineered with such things in mind. Many of these, of course, are greenfield developments, though, the term applied to service areas that are newly built on cleared or nearly cleared residential or business subdivisions. However, this isn't always the case. I recently had a relative who moved into a beautiful new subdivision in a suburb of Augusta, Georgia, one of the first whose home was up and running, only to find that the nearest broadband connection was half a mile away, with no relief, other than the local library or costly mobile connections. And this for a family that had been cord cutters. In such cases, a simple sign placed at the front of the new and developing subdivision saying, "No broadband here," might do the trick. Unfortunately, I don't think the same will work for some tenants in Tech City, but I hope that they get relief soon. And that will be all for us again this week. You have been listening to 40ANM in 5. For more information and for our terms of use, visit 40a-m.com. All stories for this week's download were reported by at least two online or print news sources or taken directly from relevant releases, with the exception of specific reporting highlighted from National Public Radio and Marketplace, The Washington Post, the International Association of Privacy Professionals, The Guardian, and the BBC. Thank you for listening. 40ANM in 5 will be back with you again on Monday, August 11th. Until then, of course, make this week and every week one to remember. and bye for now.